You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 16th of August 2016 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up on today's program.
For many years, it's been clear that the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay does not advance our national security. It undermines it. It's counterproductive to our fight against terrorists because they use it as propaganda in their efforts to recruit.
The single largest transfer of Guantanamo detainees has taken place, but with 61 people still left at the detention facility, can President Obama's vision of shutting down Guantanamo actually come to fruition? Then tension rises between the border of Russia and Ukraine. We'll have analysis on that. And in Turkey, yet another newspaper is ordered to shut down. All that, plus we'll be raising a glass at the Pyongyang Beer Festival. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome one and all to Midori House. My guests today are Mary Dajewski and John Everard. Mary Dajewski is a columnist for The Independent and The Guardian, and John Everard is a former British diplomat. He was an ambassador to Belarus, Uruguay, and since we'll be talking about this country later, it's worth pointing out, North Korea. Welcome to you both. We'll begin today's Midori House by looking at the situation in Ukraine. Over the past few weeks, tension has been rising between Ukraine and neighbouring nation Russia. Troops on both sides of the border have been placed under high alert, and the Russian Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov, has announced plans to take exhaustive measures against Ukraine. Mary Dajewski, all this comes just 1 week away from Ukraine's proposed celebration of 25 years of independence. What exactly do you think is happening in eastern Ukraine right now?
Well, it's very, very difficult to divine what's really happening. If I were forced to judge what was happening on the basis of the sort of external signals, I would say that Russia is trying to square, as it were, domestic opinion for what is going to be quite a difficult anniversary in Moscow, the 25th anniversary of Ukrainian independence, so that it's going to make quite a lot of sort of counter noise, which the rest of us really shouldn't take too seriously because we should see it in that context. But of course, they are going to have to tolerate a whole lot of rejoicing and sort of quite probably quite bombastic and nationalistic speech from, especially from Kiev, but also from the rest of Ukraine, which isn't actually in the east or in Crimea. And I think one of the reasons why we're seeing quite sort of aggressive noises, not just from Russia, but also from Kiev, I don't think we should, we can say really who is acting and who is reacting. What we have here is a potentially difficult situation for both sides. And I think that at the same time, we should look at it much more in terms of gestures than in terms of the fact that we're on the brink of some great upsurge in hostilities.
John Everard, this period was always going to be slightly tense, given that Ukraine's independence was gained from Russia, or was from the Soviet Union, but in some ways seen as being gaining independence from Moscow. So regardless of what was happening in eastern Ukraine, this was always going to be tense, in the same ways as Estonia's celebration of independence is going to not necessarily be greeted with waving flags in Moscow too.
Yes, to all that. Add to that the fact that, of course, we have legislative elections in Russia on the 18th of September, which are always create a certain amount of tension, and the fact that Russia is in deep economic trouble, which is causing a few headaches in Moscow. It's interesting that the person who actually read the riot act to Lavrov was the German Foreign Minister Steinmeier, who was in Katerinburg, I think it was, just recently, so deep in the Russian heartlands. Germany, of course, Russia's largest trading partner. If Germany decides that it wants to get nasty with Russia, it's in a position to inflict extreme pain, and Lavrov knows it. So Moscow have to play quite a delicate game here. They can't be seen to be weak. We can expect quite a lot of gestures, as Mary quite rightly points out, quite a lot of nationalist bombast, particularly as the celebration of the 25th anniversary approach, and as indeed as the Russian elections approach. But as for actual action, I share the general doubt that anything too horrible is going to happen. Russia simply has too much to lose. As for what actually happened, I mean, we've all seen these stories of a supposed incursion by Ukrainian forces stirring up trouble, planting explosives and so on. I mean, this is Keystone Cops stuff. I don't know if you've seen the video of the man that they've captured, supposedly the ringleader of this tough group of Ukrainian commandos, who sort of blunders into the room, grossly overweight, panting at the effort of having to get out of his chair, and just about pants out an obviously prepared confession in very stilted, formal Russian, the kind of Russian that nobody, not least a native Ukrainian speaker, would ever use. And then, of course, I have the whole thing that the video that they bring out to support this shows the moon in the wrong place, something of a gaffe. Not Russians or montage at its shining best, I'm afraid.
I think that's, I mean, that's obviously true, but the idea that nothing is happening between Russia and Ukraine on the ground, I think, is to ignore probably the reality that both sides are engaged in sort of little provocations on either side. I mean, we have had a couple of instances of effective sabotage on the part, apparently, of Ukrainian agents that has made life difficult in Crimea by cutting off power supplies that Russia then took quite a long time to restore. So I think there are probably special forces, deniably, on both sides, just probing what can be done, making a bit of mischief, making life difficult. And the problem, of course, is that if you then start putting troops on alert, even if you have no intention of doing anything about it, things can go wrong. And that's why I think everybody on the periphery, you know, including Western countries, who are generally lined up very much in favour of Kiev, really should do everything not to precipitate any crisis here.
Yes, absolutely. Very glad that Steinmeier sort of said to Lavrov quite simply, get your troops down, you know, stand clear, and let's not have any provocations. Exactly the right message.
And John, one of the big issues here is, you know, we can say, well, it's just gestures here and gestures there, but there's also the issue of the Minsk agreement between Russia, Ukraine, and also the forces in eastern Ukraine, which Vladimir Putin has made quite clear that he feels no progress is being made. There's not any point holding this meeting that's supposed to take place in September. How worried do you think the international community are that, you know, given that both France and Germany in particular were instrumental in that agreement coming to fruition in the first place, how worried do you think they will be about the concerns that maybe that agreement is stalling?
I think there is real reason for concern. At the same time, it's important to distinguish between an agreement that simply isn't moving forward. I mean, as you know, some of the objectives were quite ambitious, and an agreement that's going backwards. So far, the truce under the Minsk agreement is holding. Mary's quite right to point out that it has some, should we say, rough edges. Nevertheless, you know, we are not in a state of all-out war, and the truce has actually saved a lot of lives. There's some serious repair work to be done, and some hard diplomacy, and Vladimir Putin is going to have to be brought round, probably kicking and screaming, to the view that the Minsk agreement is the least bad option before him. But we're not there yet.
I don't actually think that it's Putin that needs to be convinced that the Minsk agreement is the best option. The problem is that the stalling, as I understand it currently, is actually in Kiev. And the reason the stalling is in Kiev is because the next move under the Minsk treaty has to be the granting of much more autonomy to the eastern regions, to the Donbass. And Kiev is arguing that it can't do that without jeopardizing the integrity of the whole of Ukraine. Now, I mean, I take quite a hard-line view on this because I think that they've signed up to it. And this is part of the Minsk agreement. You wouldn't have got any sort of agreement or a ceasefire without that element in it. And it's also true that I think the French and the Germans are very heavily invested in that agreement. But the problem is that a little bit further away are the British and the Americans, who are breathing hot and cold about the agreement and pointing out on Kiev's behalf that it's very difficult for Kiev to honour. Now, I don't think that's a very good idea. I think it risks undermining the agreement as it is. It's entirely right to say that, you know, we should all be grateful that it still exists, that it hasn't actually broken down. The fact it's going slowly, that's fine. But the idea that some of those who were actually in favour and persuaded Kiev to sign up to it are now suggesting that maybe there should be a few get-out clauses, I think you have to be very, very careful about that. And I would be very firmly on the side of the French and Germans here.
John, do you share that view that actually it's Ukraine that is, you know, arguably holding this up more than Russia?
Both sides are doing things which are not conducive to progress. Which side is more guilty, I think, is actually quite difficult to say. Amir is quite right. Ukraine has balked over the implementation of the autonomy for Donbass. Russia has been difficult over other areas too. It's not entirely black and white.
Okay, let's move on now and turn our focus to the US. 15 men have been transferred from Guantanamo Bay, marking the largest single transfer of detainees under Barack Obama's presidency. It arguably shows some progress, but it's still a long way to go until Obama's wish of shutting down the facility altogether can be fulfilled. Major Jevsky, we all remember, of course, that I think it was pretty much on day one, Barack Obama said, "I will close down this prison within a year." We're now definitely in year eight of the Obama presidency, and you know, he's eking it out bit by bit.
It's incredibly difficult for him in terms of domestic policy. I mean, if he had been able to do it in any way, I think he would have done it by now. The problem is twofold. There is huge domestic opposition, which goes beyond the sort of lunatic fringe of the Republican Party. It's very widely shared across the United States, and every new example of a terrorist attack is cited as a reason why not to, for Obama, why he shouldn't be honouring that promise on Guantanamo. The other reason is that it's extraordinarily difficult to find places for the remaining prisoners to go. And some of them, I mean, a couple of years ago, there was an extraordinary case of, I think, of Uyghurs being settled somewhere in the South Pacific, because there was really nowhere that was willing to accommodate them. Some of the, I think, quite a number of the most recently released prisoners should have been returning to Yemen, but it was agreed that because of the situation in Yemen, they would be accepted elsewhere in the Gulf. But persuading countries to accept prisoners from Guantanamo, however much older they are now than they were, however much more disconnected they are from where they were operating, nonetheless, there is enormous difficulty. And I think it's the practical as well as the political.
Because that's the problem, John, isn't it? One of the problems, there are many, many problems with this, is that a number of these individuals are not welcome in their own nations, or certainly by the governments in their own nations. And so there is an issue of, well, you know, can you deport someone to a nation where they're likely to be, you know, arguably tortured themselves? There's the other issue as well, John, here, isn't there, which is that the original argument why these people needed to be held in Guantanamo is because they were terrorists and they were dangerous, despite the fact they weren't charged, they weren't put on trial, so on. The danger now is that if you've been held in Guantanamo for several years, you may well actually be the sort of person who does have a grudge against America.
Yes, indeed. We have to remember that of the 15 people released in this batch, six of them were cleared for release 6 years ago. You'll be made to sit in Guantanamo Bay for 6 years, knowing that the United States itself admits there's no real reason for you to be there. Must be just a little bit galling. The point you made earlier about we need to send them somewhere and not everybody is happy to take their own nationals back. Yes, of course, a tremendous headache, particularly with the Yemenis. The instability in Yemen has been quoted by the United States in many of these cases as a reason for keeping people in Guantanamo longer than they might otherwise have wished. And it's not entirely stupid. I mean, there is a real risk to their safety in the present state of Yemen. I am fascinated by the concept that is now emerging of an irreducible minimum of prisoners in Guantanamo. We're down to 61 prisoners there. 10 of them are in various stages of the judicial process, so they might well come out. Mary's looking dubious. Yes, okay, we can't be sure, but the process underway. That still leaves 50-odd prisoners that are apparently too dangerous to release but too difficult to charge. If they're too dangerous to release, why can't they be charged? It's a question that the United States has never really answered satisfactorily. And I have seen no suggestion of any plan as to what to do with these people. Are we in the end going to keep a kind of mini Guantanamo, a kind of just a tiny facility for these last 50 people? Or are they eventually going to be moved en bloc somewhere else?
Or you move them to another military prison and therefore you can say Guantanamo is closed down.
Or that.
That was the original plan, wasn't it? I mean, when Obama first became president, I think he was negotiating with some of the states that the prisoners from Guantanamo should be, as it were, transferred to the mainland of the United States, so that at least that their legal position would be clarified, as opposed to being in this sort of no man's land of Guantanamo.
The no man's land, of course, being the point of why
they were there.
A plan that was then completely kiboshed by a politician saying, oh, well, it won't be safe enough to keep these people in our prisons, ignoring the fact there are already people that have been prosecuted for terrorism that are in American jails.
Yes, absolutely. And the fact that policy actually under Obama has changed, that people who are seen to be or accused of offences related to terrorism should be tried in an American court, which, of course, they should be. I think that the, a second element of all this is the election. And it's not just Obama's sort of a point of pride to accomplish and to honour his first promise, essentially, that he made. It's also the sort of malign legacy that he would leave to Hillary if she becomes president, that she would then have to decide what to do with this, and the whole thing could become a new political football for a new president.
John Evrard, do you think that, looking at the broader picture with what's happened in Guantanamo, and let's assume that Donald Trump doesn't become president, because then all bets in every distinction are off, but do you think that what has happened with Guantanamo will have made politicians in the US think again about how they deal with this sort of situation if it arises again? Do you think there'll be a more of a willingness to consider, you know, the Geneva Conventions again, and if America is in a war situation and they capture people, that they'll be held as prisoners of war rather than as this sort of strange sort of detainees situation?
It would be nice to think so, and surely the lesson of Guantanamo must make almost anybody in power in the United States recognize that approach simply does not work. It causes immense headaches. And as Volosky said just yesterday, not only does it consume resources, it also strains key relationships. Your allies start to get quite anxious about the kind of things you're doing. That said, I've seen no evidence at all that thinking within the Beltway has got beyond Guantanamo doesn't really work. I don't think the United States is any closer to a real solution involving or not involving the Geneva Conventions. I think it's a floundering.
Okay, we'll leave it there just for now. John Evrard and Mary Jedevsky, thank you both very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House. We're back after this.
Weighing in at almost 400 pages, the Monocle Guide to Cozy Homes is packed with everything you need to know about making a great place to live. The book is filled with handsome residences and all the contacts you need to make a home that will last a lifetime. And it's a book that celebrates the people who know homes should be able to cope with kids, dogs, and a few scuff marks too. It's a book that knows a home is only as good as the community it's in, and it's a book that takes you through the front doors of everything from mountain hideaways to modernist towers. So be cozy and buy your copy today at monocle.com.
And you're back with Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me here in the studio, Mayor Dujevsky and John Everard. 130. That's the number of media outlets that have been shut down in Turkey since a state of emergency was declared following the coup attempt. The latest of which is the pro-Kurdish newspaper Özgür Gündem, after a court ordered its closure for spreading terrorist propaganda. John Everard, this is a newspaper that since 2014 has faced a number of investigations, fines, even arrests of its correspondents. It's a miracle it's lasted this long.
It's a miracle it's lasted this long. It is nevertheless a tragedy that it's gone. It has been one of the few outlets that has put forward a point of view diametrically opposed to that of the Turkish government. The Kurds have a right to be heard. And if Ankara doesn't like what it hears, then it ought to be able to accept this, just as part of the cost of pluralism. It is very sad indeed that it has finally gone under, and that it's finally gone under in such a sudden and violent way.
Mary Dujevsky, the Turkish government is claiming that, it's not really a newspaper, it's the news outlet for the PKK. It becomes very dangerous, doesn't it, when we start claiming that newspapers or news outlets have terrorist links?
Yes, absolutely. But it's also so easy and so tempting for any government in the position of Erdogan's government to do, because the moment you are you make yourself a mouthpiece for the opposition, and an opposition is considered by the centre to be illegitimate, then it is so easy to brand that as an enemy and treachery, and therefore on the wrong side of the law. But of course, as you said, this is inimical to everything pluralistic that we sort of liked about Turkey for so long. And Turkey's media record, it has to be said, has not been wonderful over the years.
At one stage they had more journalists in jail than China.
Absolutely. And I'm never quite sure why it seems to me, at least, that Turkey seems to get quite an easy ride from precisely the people who shout very loudly about whether it's media freedom in China or in Russia or in parts of Latin America. But somehow with Turkey, the huge scale of periodic repressions and selective sort of singling out of media outlets to make it difficult for them and then impossible for them to operate, the plight of former newspaper editors in Turkey. I mean, when you look at the whole complexion, and not just, obviously, it's exacerbated when you look at the Kurdish regions, and you look at the Kurdish media or attempt by Kurdish media to be published. But it's across Turkey, and yet somehow it's something that is almost taken for granted as part of the Turkish furniture, and the outcry somehow seems less in relation to Turkey than elsewhere.
John, part of the problem here is that there are newspapers and media outlets that are essentially state mouthpieces. And as soon as you have that, then any newspaper which says it's independent will then be seen as an opposition newspaper or an opposition TV station, if you have a government that is authoritarian as this one.
If you have an authoritarian government, that's the key caveat. I mean, Austria, for example, has state paper, but doesn't have any problem in allowing fully pluralist press.
State as in its views are aligned with the government, not necessarily it's owned by government.
Yes, well, in Austria, it's actually owned by the government. I mean, it goes the whole hog. There's nothing intrinsically wrong in having a newspaper that is identified as the government paper, provided that doesn't stop everybody else having their say. And as you rightly point out, the problem is precisely that in Turkey, that hasn't happened. Erdogan has gone around swatting 130 so far outlets that happen to have views different from him. Cumhuriyet, Can Dündar's paper, is a national institution in Turkey. I mean, it's been the voice of left-wing Turkey since the 1930s, I think. I mean, it goes way back into Turkish history. And the fact that even Cumhuriyet is under threat is startling. Mary's quite right. Turkey has had a surprisingly easy ride. Cynics might say that being in a strategic position and being a member of NATO doesn't do any harm from that point of view. I get the strong sense, though, that that is over, that what Erdogan is doing has shocked Western capitals really quite deeply.
Do you really, though? Because this isn't, I mean, look, this is worse than it was, but it's on the same path. And arguably he can say, well, look, there was a coup. So, you know, I'm not making this stuff up.
No, he, of course he can say there was an attempted coup. And, you know, he can justify almost anything against that background. That doesn't mean that everybody is going to approve closing down 130 newspapers. Also, wading into the judiciary, another aspect. Three Istanbul courthouses raided in the last 48 hours, I believe. Everybody is under threat in Turkey. Is it worse than what happened before? It is as bad as the actions of both the military governments of the 60s and the early 80s, I think it was, when they first came to power. I mean, this kind of rushing around, closing down anything that doesn't look as if you can control it, is the action you take after a military coup. The fact that it is being done in the name of democracy in face of military coup is a bitter irony.
I think one of the sort of extraordinary things that's worth really pointing out is it's pretty unusual that, given the difficulties faced by the media all over Turkey, that there were still so many outlets to be closed, if you like, that there were so many people working as journalists, particularly as editors, who were extraordinary in their sort of forbearance, in the way that they carried on publishing their newspapers, almost regardless of what was thrown at them. And so, yes, you know, it's a tragedy, and it's completely reprehensible what is happening. But the sort of spirit that produced those papers is quite, is really, you know, I think it's something that really we need to appreciate, because it's something that we don't face.
Absolutely. I mean, the physical and moral courage of these people is really quite extraordinary and should be applauded. Let's hope that what happens now is the same as what happened after a previous period of repression, that the moment that the lid is lifted, these people leap back in and start publishing again. Fingers crossed.
OK, we're going to move on to our final item of the day. It is still a month or so until Oktoberfest, but fear not. If you can get yourself a visa, and this might be quite tricky, you can head to North Korea's capital, Pyongyang, where it's hosting its first ever beer festival. And John Everard, you know that the North Koreans appreciate alcohol. Is that a fair way of describing it? I think it's a fair way of describing it.
Alcoholism is a major social problem, is a fair way of describing
yes.
it. Yes.
Okay, well, that's another way of describing it. Tell us about the beer festival, because I understand it's for the small group of foreigners in North Korea. This is proving something of a hit.
Yes, North Korean beer is surprisingly good. The Taedonggang beer that is the centre of this festival is actually British beer under thin disguise. The North Koreans simply brought in a complete British brewery and run it on North Korean
really?
Lines. Yes.
Which brewery? Do you know which beer it is?
I can't now remember, I'm afraid.
Okay.
But it's a recognised brand.
It's good,
okay. Fine. Yes, and there were questions over the purity of the water they were using and some of the techniques, but that what comes out is eminently drinkable and a great deal cheaper than British beer, I rush to add. Because distribution in North Korea is always a bit of a headache, the transport infrastructure is rather rickety, there are also any number of microbreweries around North Korea, breweries in the back of restaurants that will produce really quite a plausible brew, including one famous one on top of one of the department stores in North Korea that produces, I think, the world's only bright green beer. I'm not quite sure how they turn it green, but it doesn't actually taste anything like as bad as it looks.
Okay. Well, that's quite something. Mary, would this appeal to you if you were in Pyongyang right now? You're making
a
face.
Well, probably in the absence of pretty much anything else in Pyongyang at the moment, maybe you'd be grateful for some more mercies. And it's true that across the region, you look at Japan, you look at China, you look at South Korea, they can all produce a decent beer, so why shouldn't North Korea? But I actually confess to being a wine drinker, and so far as I know, and probably to the benefit of the rest of us, North Korea has not yet gone in for vine growing.
It has, but you really don't want to know.
Okay, we'll leave it there. John Everard and Mary Dzhevsky, thank you both very much indeed. That's it for Midori House. It was produced by Carlotta Ribello. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Molly Ingleby. The studio manager was Kira Matthew Benerji. Carlotta's here next with music, then at 1900 hours. It's a very special edition of Section D, hosted by Madrid correspondent Liam Aldous. Do tune in to that. Midori House, back same time tomorrow, 1800 here in London, 1300 in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Have a lovely day. Goodbye.